Welcome to 21. My name is Drew Lasker. I'm a proud father, husband, son, professional basketball player, lifelong athlete, and business owner of Train Harder 21. I have partnered with Yvonne Harris to create this podcast that will explore the life and lessons that come along with being an athlete while continuing to inspire athletes at all levels to achieve optimal performance. Why 21, you might ask? It is my jersey number and has been a part of my good fortune and great career. So it seems like a fitting name for this podcast.
Hi, everyone. This is Yvonne Harris. I'm fortunate to experience firsthand how Drew's expertise and care for his clients have a positive, measurable impact on athletes. And not just from the perspective of physical ability. Drew helps his clients to transform their mental game, which is just as important, if not more important, than the physical game. He also equips his student athletes with the knowledge to think beyond just playing sports and how to leverage sports to create a successful life and career. Drew is living proof that the journey won't always be easy, but with grit and an openness to the possibilities, the outcome will be better than you know. Enjoy this episode of 21.
Welcome back to the 21 Podcast, where today we finish the story of how Fab ended up in England in the British Basketball League. We start with a little insight from Drew on the inspiration for our show. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the ride.
I want to dedicate this episode to your brother, James Flournoy. Just like for our listeners out there, this podcast, 21, is dedicated to Yvonne's mother, Dr. Carol Plummer Harris, and to my grandmother, Vera Lott. And so, you know, no one can prepare you for death, especially when it's someone close. You know, we've all, three of us have experienced that. And the toughest part about it is trying to pick up the pieces. And like you say, you go through a range of emotions of wanting to give up, asking the question why, and then, but ultimately you have to move forward. And so for you, I like that word that you used, is not a grind, and that it's a journey. And what a journey it's been for you to be able to go through that situation. And then obviously parlaying that and coming to England. And for you, because this story is fascinating, I don't want to give it away, but just talk about the person that helped get you this opportunity in the UK, your first basketball professional opportunity.
My first basketball opportunity came in combination of a lot of good people. Ron Everhart, my college coach, Coach Mike Wilson, again, one of my another high school coach. And obviously, as my sister liked to call him, Uncle Nick, Nick Nurse. Coming out of college, obviously I went back and, you know, again, I wanted to graduate on time. So when I went back to, you know, and I was at McNeese, I was taking 24 credits and on time. And my whole thing is I wanted to graduate on time. And because I went to a junior college and transferred to a four-year school, all my credits didn't transfer over. So I was behind. And again, I only had a two-year scholarship. So my scholarship ran out in 2 years and I was due to graduate. It would have taken me 4 years and I wanted to do it in two. So again, for 4 years, all I did was basically go to school I was in school every day for 4 years from 8 to 5 o'clock every day, you know, nonstop. And then had practice and study hall at night. So we had practices and we had life and then started. So from every day, basically from 8 to about 10 o'clock, that was my life. It was school, basketball, and I wanted to play and I wanted to continue playing. And obviously I just didn't have the skills at that point in time to make it into the NBA, and it was the CBA. And, you know, my whole thing was, you know, I want to play basketball and I don't want to go back to New York. My college coach offered me a job coming out of college, and eventually I was like, no, that's not for me. You know, I don't want to coach. I don't want to, you know, and I don't want to live in Lake Charles, Louisiana. And I don't want to go back. And I do have to go to New York, but I don't want to live there. That's not for me. So at that point in time, you know, Coach Everhart spoke to Coach Wilson, and Coach Wilson got in contact with one of the guys that he knew. And one of the guys that he knew was a guy by the name of Nick Nurse. And Nick Nurse had put together a tour team. Nick Nurse had just, he had coached in, you know, Derby, England. And he had did the, you know, the player coach thing. And, you know, he was trying to help basketball players get their chance. Shout out to Nick Nurse. And is, you know, it's a great read. Rapture, his book, he just put his book out, just coaching about just damn near anywhere. So how to coach damn near anywhere, 15 continents, and 15 country, 15 places and everything. So it's a great, great book. Sorry, put that plug in, but you know, if we're going to talk about the man, let's talk about the man. Nick Nurse was putting together a tour team, and he just, you know, he figured it out himself. It was no agency. You know, he did the sums. The man is a quiet little genius in his own right. And he put together a tour team because he knew England, and, you know, he was trying to help basketball players out. And he put together a bunch of players who were graduating, and he had them put on a showcase and brought the American players over to England and had them play the various teams in England with the hopes of the Americans getting the opportunity to pick up a job. And I was contact, Mike Wilson had contacted Nick Nurse and told Nick Nurse, you got a player for you, might want to look at it. And Nick called me up and said, would you like? And I said, yes. And then, you know, it was going to cost like about something like $900, I believe it was, which took care of your flights and took care of your meals and all that. And Nick, you know, he did the math and, you know, he figured it out of, you know, hotels, where to stay at, where to do the food at and touring and, you know, all that other type of stuff. So I did that. And I remember going over there, and I remember just like everything else, I was like, I'm going to play my heart out. I'm going to play harder than anybody. And, you know, and I'm not a shooter. I'm not this, but I can play. And I remember going there, and we played against Derby. We played against, I believe we played against lots of players in the BBL, the older players then, the English players. I remember Alan Cunningham, Henlin, Clyde Vaughn, I believe, you know, there was, you know, a lot of players from Derby and just playing. And I remember at the end of it, you know, I never got picked up by any of the teams. And I remember just getting back, and I remember talking to Nick, and I remember just saying, like, I don't care about the money, you know, I just need an opportunity. And if I get an opportunity, you know, I'll take care of it. I just want to play, you know, just let me just get, he said, yeah, Fab, he said, if I ever get a chance, if there's anything I can do, you know, I'll give you a call and, you know, I'll see what I can do. So I never got anything. And then a year, obviously that was the year that my brother passed. And then a coach told me to go to New York. And I said, I mean, stayed in. I told them, no, I'm going to go home to New York. And I remember getting a job at that point in time. And, you know, I remember saying myself, I went to school for 4 years. I got a degree. You know, I did everything the right way. And I'm working at the security at the Gap. And here I am seeing some of my friends and, you know, that I played ball with in the city, and they driving around in Mercedes Benz, and they got this and that. I'm with the school, and I was just contemplating, did I do the right thing? Why, you know, I'm just like, what am I, look at me now, and I'm not playing. And I did a lot of soul searching, and I was like, well, at the end of the day, I just have to, you know, do whatever it is that I got to take to help my mom. And I was making pretty good money. It was just, but I never imagined that it would be that. And the one thing that I did not want to do is to, you know, be pumping gas at a gas. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I just did not want to end up in New York. And there I was in New York. So I remember sitting down and I was just writing things down. And I remember writing it down and was like, there got to be some place that I can play basketball in this world. There has to be some place. And I remember saying, you know, all right, I'm going to work for about 2 months and save as much money as I can. And I did that. I saved like 2 months worth of work. And then I quit my job. And I remember saying to myself, I'm going to give myself a year to work out, to practice, to play, and to get on someplace where I don't know. But at that point in time, playing with, I was doing like the N1 stuff, because that's when N1 was coming around, and like my man Headache, and you had Helicopter, you had Future, you had like, again, I'm on that scene, and I'm working out, and I'm playing, and I'm going, you know, I'm playing with Dykeman Basketball, Jim Couch.
Yeah.
I'm playing it. I'm a part of that team, and I'm there, and I'm just working out. Going to all the Nike Pro Am, Pro City, Pro workouts, and I'm just trying to get on, trying to get seen. And again, no one really wanted, and that's because I don't necessarily have a skill. I'm undersized, I'm not really a guard. I'm not really forward. I really can't shoot. But at the end of the day, I'm always winning. I'm always on a winning team. And I'm always, being very successful. Like I've won street tournaments. I played in, 155th Rucker. I played in the Dykeman tournament. I played in Kingdom. I played in Brooklyn. I played in Housen. I played, like, if you name it, I played it. I was there and I was successful there. And I didn't get one of those names. And I'm just like fat. Everybody know who I was. Fat, just, quiet, didn't say anything. And I was playing with Dave and the Young Boys. And, I was playing with Rafer Austin, AKA Skip to My Lou. And, I was playing with, I was playing with the franchise. at that point in time, and all that aliases, and I'm like, I'm gonna be ready for when that moment comes. And no matter what, I'll say to you, and I'll say it to everyone right now. There's going to come a moment, and everybody is going to have a moment and an opportunity. I can't tell you what that opportunity is, and I can't tell you what that moment is. I can't tell you when it's going to come. I can't tell you how it's going to come. I can't even tell you where it's going to come. But I am going 100% cold-heartedly, with all my belief, tell you that that moment is going to come. And when that moment comes, you better be ready. And it's just that simple. And the reason why I say that is because without a plan, without anything there or wherever, that summer, 8 months later, after quitting my job or whatever, working, playing these tournaments or whatever, the phone ring, and it was Nick Nurse. Say, hey, Fab. So what you doing? I said, I'm not doing anything. He said, oh, are you still interested in playing? I said, hell yeah. He said, well, I got this job in England. I was there for a year. They're changing the rules around, and, they're allowing another import player. And, I always said that if I had a spot, if I had an opportunity, I would give you a shot. He said, do you want to play? I said, yeah. He said, well, it's not much money. I said, remember I told you it had nothing to do with money. He said, all right, well, I'll bring the contract, and I'm going to be in New York, scouting and looking at some players and whatever. So he flew to New York the next day, 2 days later, and he saw me playing. He said, Fab, it's good. I like what you're doing here. Keep working, playing. He said, here's the contract. You didn't take a time. I said, yeah, no, take time to look it over. Just give it here. Signed it and gave it to him. And so ain't nothing to look at. So you need to look at it. Nope, don't need to look at it. So you gave me what I needed. And then all of a sudden, again, everything changed. Like all of a sudden, now I had a contract. Now I was playing. Now I had something to play for. But more importantly, before that, I knew that was going to come. And I'm a firm believer in when you put yourself in the right position and you keep that mindset going of how to win and how to prepare and being ready and knowing that, things come, the universe, I believe that for all those out there that know the universe, that, you know, speak it into the universe, it happens, it comes that way. You know, those forces shape. And the thing is, you can't be disingenuous about it. You have to be, that has to be your calling. And for me, that was my calling. And my calling being that I was going to be ready for that moment when it come, when it came, and that moment happened. Now, that moment could have been anybody else. That moment could have been a basketball game. That moment could have been this. That moment could have been. But basketball, to me, has materialized everything that I needed. Everything. I needed an education. Basketball provided. I needed to get out of New York. Basketball provided. I needed food. Basketball provided. I needed to learn, basketball provided. I needed help with my brother, basketball provided. Basketball provided everything for me. It was the tool, and it was the tool that I chose to use. And if you're gonna use that tool, you gotta know how to use that tool. You gotta be prepared to use that tool. You gotta be prepared to, you know, everyone turn around and sacrifice. You gotta be prepared to put in that work. Nick didn't give me that job because of my skill. He gave me that job because he was a coach and he saw how hard I play and what I was willing to do. And when he contacted my coach, Mike Wilson, he told him the same thing. We contacted Coach Everall, he told him the same thing. When he contacted, all this gets traced all the way back to those days that I was playing at Claremont Neighborhood Center and when I was playing Virgil. And I had to figure out how it what I need to do in order to win. And I was willing to do whatever it takes. There was nothing that was going to stand in my way. And I'm the type of person, and, you know, I've been known to do a lot of crazy things, but they're not crazy. They're things that lead in a straight line. When I say a lot to know the crazy things, Drew, obviously you know me. If it's talking about diet, if it's talking about working out, if it's talking, like, for example, you know, I wanted to correct my posture and I wanted to fix my back alignment. And one of the things that I learned was the fact of that you have to, you know, the best place is to sleep on the floor. So for a year, I got rid of my bed. I slept on the floor. There was and there was no way out. So there was no it's you do it or you don't do it. And you know, when I turned around and, you know, I went fruitarian with my diet, walked in the house and one day I just turned around and got rid of all my food. You know, you can look at something as a prison or you can look at something as a feeding ground. So, for example, if someone turned around and they gave, Yvonne, if I turn around and I gave you some, you know, I gave you some, let's say fruit, I gave you some oranges and I gave you some apples and I gave you some pineapples and I gave you some your coconuts and I gave you like five different fruits for you to go sell. And Drew, I gave you another five, you know, and I gave you five vegetables. Right, you know, and you can go sell them, and I'm giving, and then I give the next person. Let's say I give them a lemon. Right, who's going to be able to make the most? Now you can turn around, you can say, well, I got five different options. Both of you, Vaughn, you got five different options, five different fruits, and five different, you know, Drew, you can turn around, I got five different vegetables, got five different weights. Yeah, you do, and then you can turn around and say, me, I have, you know, one lemon. I have one way. That means that I can become a master of that one thing. And that one thing, if I have a lemon, then all of a sudden I'm going to be thinking, how can I get this lemon? How am I going to be able to work with this lemon? I can make lemonade. I can make lemon meringue pie. I can make, I can take off the zest of the lemon and, you know, and use the zest, you know, as a soap. As a toothpaste, I can combine it. There becomes all, if you limit yourself to thinking one way and limit yourself to thinking that this is all I have instead of thinking about the opportunities that there, it becomes so simple that you have that one thing, that you can grow that one thing, that one thing gets all of your attention. You're not divided. You're not, it's nothing, nothing is taken away from you. You're able to concentrate. You're able to nurture it. You're able to grow it. You're able to understand it, to get in rhythm with it, to be able to breathe with it, to be able to feel its pulse, to know that everything that there is, to a point that it becomes you and you become a part of it, it's limitless with the things that you can do, if that makes sense. And I attribute that and have that same philosophy with everything that I do, because that's what it was always like for me. When you dive into something and you truly dive into it and you become one with it and you believe it, and I don't care what it is. It can be, you know, it could be family, it could be money, it could be education, it could be whatever it is you choose it to be, because everybody's motivation is different. What makes you tick might not make the next person tick, but it has to make you happy. It has to make you feel complete. It has to make you feel accomplished. It has to be one of those defining moments. And then no matter what happens, my goal wasn't to make a lot of money from basketball. My goal wasn't to be a coach of basketball. I never wanted to coach. I happened to coach, but I never wanted to be a coach. It just happened that way because I love playing basketball. I love being a part of the team. I love competing. I love bringing out the best in me. And, you know, I'm not going to allow anyone to take that away, because one thing that I know how to do is I know how to win. And I don't care where I'm at. I don't care what team I'm in. I don't care what the odds are. I'm going to win, because that's the only route that I have. And everything in my DNA, everything that I've gone through, always point to that direction. As Jay-Z said, I'm headed to the top. If you come in, come on, because that's where I'm going. And I'm not stopping in between. Get on board or get left behind. And I don't care what anybody may think of me or what they may say of me or whatever it is that they feel, that's where I'm headed. That's what I'm about. That's where I'm going. And no one can tell me any different, you know? And one of the things that I say, it's not a grind. They don't really realize how relentless that I am when my job as a coach is to make you a better person. And the reason why I know that is because I had two coaches die trying to make me a better person and did everything that they can to make me a better person. I had teachers who took the time out to teach me how to read, to make me a better person. I had people, my oldest brother, give up his life and give up doing things to make me a better person. I had Nick giving me an opportunity when he didn't have to make me a better person. How can I not expect that and give that back to everyone? How can I not, you know, have that approach in the basketball game? How can I not have that approach in the locker room? So when it came to the BBL, and when I was playing all these years in the BBL, and everyone said, don't you get tired of winning? How do you get tired of trying to be the best person that you can be? How do you get tired of trying to create the best version of yourself? And I think when I was in the BBL and we was playing, and yeah, everybody kept saying, well, give somebody else a chance. Or you too old, or you too, I don't allow people to put I have my own limitations.
Right.
I'm not gonna let somebody put their limitations on me because they can't do it, because they can't see a way out. Just because they can't see a way doesn't necessarily mean that I can't see a way. And it had nothing to do with age. It had nothing to do with, you know, well, we were at one point in time, I was too young to win in the BBL. Because I was one of the youngest coach, and then at one point in time, I was too old to win in the BBL. Then I heard the whole saying that, oh, you have the most money in the league. What money?
it's always something. But let's talk about that limit, because obviously you shared about how Nick Nurse gave you your first opportunity. And then if I'm correct, were you cut in that first year and then you played for the B team? Is that correct?
That is correct. You just don't have the timing right on it. So my first year, I was introduced to the league and playing, and that's where I came across Nigel Lloyd.
Right.
Nigel Lloyd, Clive Allen, Tony Sims, and, you know, and the crew, the Birmingham crew and Nick. And that's where essentially they taught me, you know, the BBL. They taught Harry Rubeski, Tim Rudge. You know, they taught me, you know, the league and how the league operate. And then the second year, Nick had left. Nick had got another job offer and he had left going into Europe. And that's when we won my second year. So Nick won the year before I got there. Then I had a year with him and then he left. And then I won that second year. Then the third year was when, you know, I got cut. The third year was when, you know, we had the owner had left Harry Rubeski, and Harry Rubeski, he was from Australia, and he had went back to Australia, and our Birmingham Bullets at that point in time was partly funded and was in partnership with the Sydney Kings, Australian team.
So we were
the sister parent in England. So obviously they was branching out because the BBL was branching out. So Harry had decided to sell the team and go back to Australia. And when he did, we had gotten taken over by Craig Bowne. When Craig Bowne came in, with, you know, all different ideas of how to run the league and everything. And at that point in time, for whatever reason, I was a target of Craig Bowne. And, you know, and to this day, I don't know. But that first year, you know, they didn't do right by me in lots of ways. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, in terms of whether or not, you know, to pay me and to help. I just don't think that they thought I was good enough and I was a waste of import from a management standpoint. And at that point in time, I was there and I wanted to secure my legacy within playing, because at that point in time I was doing 3 years, and rules have changed, and I had wanted to play in the UK for a long time. And that's when I learned about the league and learned about the paperwork and how I can go from a permit player to a non-permit player to citizen. And, you know, and at that point in time, Craig knew about this, and, you know, he just made my life difficult at the time. And when I say difficult, you know, I was essentially paying to play basketball because he was trying to make me quit. And by trying to make me quit, you've seen it before in college, and when you heard a coach is going to try and run you off and make your life difficult, and, you know, and it was essentially the same thing was happening with him. And, you know, it wouldn't pay me and had me doing, you know, schools. And when I said doing schools, you know, give me a bag of basketballs and tell me to go to, you know, to an after school club and, you know, coach basketball, take the subs at that point in time in England and then take it and pay the money to the club. It was, you know, and as I was doing that, you know, I had to pay for my own gas. I didn't get any expenses. And, you know, I had to pay my own insurance on the car, and I had to pay the rent at the house, and I wasn't having to have any of my bills paid for. And I don't have any money at this point in time. So, you know.
So how did you fund this? Obviously, you weren't getting paid at the time. You having to basically finance your life. So how did you do it?
So remember when I told you I have this knack for figuring out how to win and how to be successful? It starts with two C's.
I got it. Yvonne said you got it figured out, Yvonne.
It took me a minute. I'm there.
I'll say it. First C is credit. Second C is card.
Free money, huh?
Yeah, it was free money. Obviously, at this point in time, you know, I'm playing overseas and playing basketball. And, you know, my first 2 years, I didn't necessarily make bad. My first year, I didn't really make any money. It wasn't about money. My second year, I got a pay raise. And then my third year, I got another pay raise. And when I'm talking about, I was making like, what was it at a time? I was making £100 a week. That's £400 a month. You know, if you do the math, maybe about eight grand over the course of the
For context for our Americans out there, that's approximately about, during those times, about $750 a month.
Yeah. So, you know, it was nothing in it. And then that was my first month, but $750 a month, you know, and then all my bills are paid for, and I got one meal for free and sugar. It was better than, you know, it was better than, you know, being in New York, and it was better than, because I'm going to break my way up. So my next year, you know, I went from, you know, 700, 750, and I went to 1,000. And I'm like, I'm making 1,000. I'm balling now, you know? So, you know, and at that point in time, I'm thinking, you know, the third year, I'm going up to, you know, to 1,200. And I'm like, I'm whatever it takes. So now I'm going up to 1,200. And then all of a sudden, my checks are late. And, you know, you're not this, and I'm not getting paid this, and I'm not that. And then all of a sudden, you have all these things. And I'm like, well, I do another year, and, you know, I become a non-work permit. And then another year after that, I can eventually get my passport. And then with the Bosman rule, now I'll be able to play as a citizen. And then all of a sudden, a lot of the English players are going and playing in Europe. And I already did that. And then going back to what I've done before when I was in college, like I did years where I didn't go home. I did where I didn't see my family. And then equally, the money that I was getting, I was taking, I was sending home and giving to moms to help out brothers and sisters. So I was just, you know, I was just living. You know, it didn't necessarily matter for me. So as I'm, you know, going through these trials and tribulations with Craig, and, you know, I'm getting up, you know, the credit cards and all this type of stuff, you know, I racked up, you know, a lot of debt because I knew nothing about, what is it, that APR? that APR, you know, they tell you can take this money, buy now, pay later, with the interest rates. And the interest rates at that point in time was at 29.9%. And I didn't know what those numbers were. So that's basically, I have to pay that money back plus 30% of whatever it was. And then you say, oh, you don't have to worry about it. All you have to do is just pay the minimum. Yeah, and at the minimum, you know, I'm turning around, I'm paying all this, and I'm paying the minimum. And the minimum was about $5, £5, £10, $20 or whatever. And I'm like, okay, yeah, I'll pay it off. And then all of a sudden, this debt is amassing. And obviously, I don't know about it. Well, I know about it, but I'm not aware of it. So I don't have, you know, you don't have the financial advisors and tell you. The only one thing I'm thinking about is I need this credit card, I need to pay this bill, I need to pay rent, I need to pay council tax. What is council tax? I know I have to make it to survival, because if I'm able to endure this and I get my passport, then everything else will take care of itself. So I'm going to have to do this. And at that point in time, Craig knew it. And, you know, I'm on the team. So then all of a sudden, he cut me from the team. And then they bring in another American. They bring in, Corey Jackson, and, you know, and we had a team full of talent. That's when I was playing. I had York Williams, we had Justin, we had Nigel, we had, who else did we have? We had Lee Walker, from Thames Valley at that point in time. We had a crew. And we just didn't gel because the coaching wasn't necessarily right for the team that we had. I believe we also had Mark Robinson at that time as well. And then, you know, and it wasn't necessarily, when I say the coaching wasn't right, because management wasn't right. So the coaching wasn't right, and it was Mike Finger. Mike Finger couldn't get a hold of us as players because we were all dealing with Craig. And obviously Craig, the owner at that point in time, he, you know, as an owner, he want to be involved. He want to run a basketball team, and he's a businessman trying to run a basketball team, and he don't have no idea about the basketball. And then you got the coach in the middle of the team, and he's trying to, you know, get the guys to understand he want to play this way, but the guys understand they're dealing with Craig and, you know, dealing with money and all that other type of stuff. So it didn't necessarily work. So we was just dropping games that we shouldn't have dropped. So then all of a sudden, he turned around and said, well, Fab, you know, we're going to let you play for the A team. So that was the Div 1 team, the A team. So as I'm playing for them, because as an American, I have my import, and then I can, as an import, I have the non-work permit. I'm playing for the A team. And, you know, I'm the leader of that team, and I'm getting up, playing hard, and I'm working with the players and everything. So then they having all these problems with the senior team,
And I'm there and I'm in practice. Now I have to go to practice. I have to go to these schools. I have to be in the community. I have to, you know, go to the office. I have to, you know, and pay all my bills. So I'm just like scrambling. But at the end of the day, I'm still playing basketball. And at the end of the day, I'm still going to see this through. So then he turned around and said, you could Fab, you, everybody really likes you and whatever. So you know what? I think you should commentate at our game. So that was my new role. So now I'm going to have to commentate at the game. So I would literally, you know, go come from a school, working in a school, working in a community, right? Come play in our basketball game. Then as soon as I play in our basketball game, shower, change, get on the microphone, right? And then commentate in the senior team. And I'm commentating, not trying to be spiteful, not trying to be mad, knowing that I was supposed to be out there, knowing that I would have been out there last year, having people turn around and look at me and say, well, what happened? And you're still here, and having to swallow that ego and understanding that my purpose is bigger than that. And, you know, it was just all those emotions. And then eventually, again, it happened, you know, the team wasn't doing well. And then, you know, they cut everybody. And then, you know, Craig decided that he wasn't going to pay anybody. So then they pulled me back into the team. And then when they pulled me back into the team, right, obviously we playing well and we playing good and we playing and we made it to the final. And we lost to Manchester against Nick Nurse, who had the super team with Manchester. Now, again, I ain't have nothing. And I'm playing in the fine playing in the playoff final. Like, and again, as I said before, I have this knack. And I know it sounds like I'm being egotistical. I know how to win. I know how to galvanize a team. I just whatever it takes to win, I'm willing to do. So now at this point in time, this is all happening to me. And I'm like, okay, after this year, I'm out. I'm getting my passport. I don't care where I go, but I ain't staying here. So at this point in time, you know, we played a fight. We lost in the final. And that one hurt. And we should have won that game. And we didn't win that game because I didn't pull one rebound. There was one rebound that me and Tony Dorsey went up for, and Tony Dorsey got it. And when he got that rebound, it pretty much sealed the game. For all those BBL stories, you want to go back and watch the game, you'll know what it is that I'm talking about. Anyway, you know, side note, you know, I've won a lot. I can't tell you about any of my wins. I can tell you about the ones we lost, though. but anyway, so now I'm saying to myself, I want out. And I don't care where, I just want out. So I put out there in the league and I put out, you know, I was writing letters to clubs and to teams like, you know, I got one more year to get my passport. You know, if you take a chance on me now, I'll play for you for free or whatever. Just to, and I remember, you know, sending the letters out, sending the cover letters out there, and I ain't get no response from nobody. I remember hitting Vince up. I remember hitting Newcastle up. I remember hitting Hemel up. I remember hitting Towers up. I remember, like, I was just basically offering myself to league. And I'll never forget that. Nobody, I got nothing, no response from nobody. So then finally, Terrell, I heard it, and, you know, Milton Keynes had, I mean, Sheffield had heard it, and then Chris, he had got in contact with me, and then Chris turned around and said, I heard you're interested in playing and whatever, just the dynamics of the team, and this is Chris Finch. So Chris Finch turned around and said, and I told Chris the same thing I told Nick, just give me a chance, and I'll take care of the rest. I don't care about the money, just get me out of here, and I'll take care of the rest. And then, obviously, I get the opportunity to leave Birmingham, and then I'll go to Sheffield. And again, when I'm at Sheffield, same thing happened. I'm not playing as much. You know, we didn't do as well as we should do. But at the same time, Chris, that dynamic between Nick and Chris as coaches, they taught me so much, in particular about basketball and equally about the BBL. And now I'm here and I'm with them and I'm in practice and I'm, you know, I'm on this journey and learning how they work. And, you know, I'm in this, you know, this little struggle, you know, trying to find my place again, make it to another final. Okay. and didn't win, but we won the league, won the finals. So now all of a sudden I'm like, okay, I'm ready to stay at Sheffield. And I'm like, okay, can I get another job? Can I get another gig and whatever? And then Sheffield turn around and say, they weren't necessarily interested in me, right? And I was mad, but I wasn't mad at Chris, because Chris turned around and said, Fab, let me just tell you point blank, you know, I would like to have you back, but there's no room for you because they're looking at bringing Justin in. Justin was just at Birmingham with me. Justin Phoenix was at Birmingham because I was the year ago I was at Birmingham. And now obviously he wants to make the move. He wants to get out of Birmingham. He wants, and obviously he's coming to Sheffield. So obviously they don't want me at Sheffield no more. So I'm like, okay, but Chris, to this day, I love that man too, because Chris turned around, look, you know what? I'm going to pick up the phone. And he called Tony G, and he spoke to Tony G and told Tony G, you know what? You might want to take that. Fab is here, you know, wherever, you know. So Chris made sure that Chris couldn't help me with his team, but he made sure that I was taken care of. And that's going back to the same thing of as a coach. Every coach has always helped me. Every coach has looked out for me. Every coach has always put me in a position where I can thrive and where I can succeed.
Right. So he basically, he vouched for you. And, you know, it's funny how you go through these years of you trying to scratch and claw for a career. And so you go from Birmingham to Sheffield and then ultimately Newcastle with Tony G. And you spend all these years trying to fight and claw for a career. And then you get an opportunity as a coach, but not a coach, a player coach. Kind of talk us through that moment of how that process happened of you being offered the player coach job. First of all, was coaching, did you ever have any aspirations of coaching?
I had no aspirations of coaching, and still to this day don't. When I say that, I always wanted to play. And that's why it's significant, because I told you before, my college coach had already offered me a job and I turned it down. My college coach Everhart offered me a job at back at Magnesium. That was paying about 80 grand a year at that point in time. And that was a no for me. It was a no for me coming out, because that's not ultimately where I want to be or where I want to do. So going all the way here, when I came up to Newcastle my first year, when we was playing, we had ran the league in preseason, and then I got injured. And when I got injured, I didn't play that whole season until the end. And when I came back again, I came back and we making the playoffs, and we down in the semifinal, and we down to go into the championship. Ultimately, we lose. So then after that year, I was in and around the team, and I was there, but I wasn't playing. And you know, that's when I was around Paul and Sam, Paul Blake, the general manager of Newcastle, and then Tony. And I got injured, and then I only played a handful of games. So at the end of the year, Tony had decided to leave Newcastle, and he was going to Birmingham. And when he went to Birmingham, because Birmingham was going to play in Europe then. And at that point in time, I was saying to myself that, oh, sugar, you know, another coach is leaving, because every coach that I had, again, I've only been under them for 1 year. I only had Nick for 1 year. I only had Chris for 1 year. I only had Finger for 1 year. So my whole BBL career was mixed with coaches for 1 year. So now I'm thinking I was hurt, and all of a sudden the coach is gone. I don't know if I'm going to get a job. And I'm like, I wanted out of Sheffield. I wanted out of Newcastle. I wanted out of Birmingham. I wanted to stay at Sheffield. They didn't want me. And now Tony's left and I've been injured. I said, and I don't know who the coach is going to be. So I remember panicking, like, I don't have a job. And I remember Paul coming up to me and saying that, you know, he wants to, you know, he has an idea, and, you know, he wants to hire Pete Scantz. But before you look at hiring Pete Scantz, he went out, because Pete Scantz was at Sheffield at that time, Peter Scannerberry. Peter Scannerberry, all-time great, you know, BBL, You know, veteran. I love Pete. Pete taught me a lot. I play with a lot of players. And one day I'm going to mention them all and let them all know. But anyway, so Pete's wife was from Newcastle. So Pete Skans also played in Newcastle before he went to Sheffield. So it was going to be a case where it was hire Pete Skans because he's the next up and coming coach. And Pete lived in Sheffield, played in Sheffield, and now all of a sudden they were grooming him to take over from Chris Finch, because at some point in time Finch was going to go. So Paul said, I want to interview Pete Skans, but before I interview Pete Skans, and you know, I think he's going to go to Sheffield, I want to offer you the job of coaching. And I said, no. I said, hell no. I said, I have no interest in coaching at all. And he said, well, I don't want to just offer you a coach. I want you to be a player coach. And then I remember laughing at him. I was like, a player coach? I said, no. I vehemently said, coaches should coach and players should play. I said, it's not viable. I said, I want to play. And then he said to me, he said, look, Fab, just think about it. And, you know, I'm going to offer you the job anyway. And I remember saying to myself, good, he's going to offer me the job anyway. And I think I need to sign his contract real quickly, because if he hires a coach, the way my track record go, the coach might not want me. So, you know, and I know the league and I'm not going to be in position, you know, and I'm getting my passport this year or whatever. So I'm like, okay, I just, you know, yeah, whatever. Let's do it quick. So he turns around and, you know, he offers me the contract and, you know, I signed a contract and I'm thinking, okay, I'm set, I'm good, you know, I ain't got nothing to worry about. And then about 2 weeks later, it was just before my birthday, it was just at my birthday, July 31st, you know, a day or two after my birthday, he calls me up and he says, Fab, you know, just so you know, I think we, you know, what do you think about the player coach thing? I said, Paul, I'm not interested in player coach. He said, I can help you. I said, no, I'm not interested in it. You know, and then he said, look, I'm gonna be honest with you, Fab. I'm under the gun right now. You know, I'm under the pressure right now. And, you know, the season is going to start. Because back then the season used to start real early. The season used to start in August, like August 15th and August, you know, preseason August 15th and early September was when the season used to start. And I remember saying to myself, okay, if you don't help, you're going to lose. And if you lose, because they might bring in a coach in and they ain't got no players in, and I don't see how we're going to win. And at the end of the day, I want to win. So I remember telling him, okay, look, he said, I'll help you, or I can help you and you can help me. But as soon as you get an opportunity, you know, bring in a coach. And, you know, and he said, yeah, he said, I'm going to bring a coach in as soon as I get an opportunity, as soon as we get a chance. And then, and you know, it, and that was it. And from that point on, it was what it was. He's never brought in coach in, and I was still waiting for him to bring a coach in, and he never did. And equally, I took on a role, and the one thing that I took on the role was to basically be able to pay back everything that Tony G has done for me, because Tony G called me up and told me that I should take the job. Tony G as a coach, Chris as a coach, because Tony G got me and helped me in Newcastle. Chris Finch got me to Tony G. Nick Nurse got me to Finchy. Coach Everhart got me to coach Nick Nurse and Coach Wilson. and Coach Ed Hall got me the Nick Nurse. Bill Peterson, who also coached at for the Milwaukee, coached at McNeese State. He was the one who recruited me, and he got me to McNeese State. Coach Artie Apple got me out of New York. He was a junior college coach. Coach Bill Chapman, Coach Chap, was my high school coach, and Coach Mike Harris. So it went from all the lessons that I learned from Mike Harris to Bill Chapman to Artie Apple to Ron Everhart to Nick Nurse to Chris Finch to Tony Garbaletto to Fat Flannoy.
I'm pretty sure all those guys would be proud to see your career as a coach. And like you say, you took a little piece of everything you learned from those guys and you parlayed that into, 25 trophies with the Newcastle Eagles, an MBE in 2017. And not only, because a lot of people, they focus on your coaching career, and you were a damn good player as well. It was many times where, if I could describe your game, you're probably one of the most versatile players that I've ever come across. You could play 1 through 5. If we go back to the 2011 season when you guys clean swept, when you were down one American, you started the season. You started the game as a point guard. You come on the bench. Then you come in the game as a 5, as a big man. I don't think you get enough credit for a player, but I would say you were just as good a player as you were a coach. And then, this whole thing for you, it comes back full circle. Your professional career started with the phone call from Nick Nurse, and then it ends with the phone call with Nick Nurse to invite you to the NBA.
Yeah, that was great. And it was also scary because he threw me off again. And the reason why I hope you can smile, because you knew about that.
Yeah.
Obviously he was there. And
yeah.
Knew what was in the pipeline. Because I'm not going to go too much into the details of that. But I will talk about it a little bit. It was going to come, but the timing of it, I felt I didn't want to be ready for that. And I also felt that it was, again, as I said before, the gods or, karma or the opportunity coming and calling. And it only comes and call once, and you have to be ready. There'll be other opportunities, there'll be other things, but certain things only happen at that point in time. And when he made that phone call, and he kept an eye on me for a long time, and he would check on me, and and I would see him in summers and times, and that whole thing of how it happened and when it was happening, it was difficult because obviously it was happening prior to when everybody knew it was happening, or prior to anyone when he was expecting it to happen, because he had told me, he had told me before, like years before, just like when he told me before, if he ever had opportunity and space for me or whatever, he was going to come. And do you remember where you were at when I first told you? And because I do believe I told you in Dallas.
Me and Dee at the same time.
And that was probably the most difficult thing, because you knew I didn't want to go, and I told y'all I didn't want to go, but at the same time I knew I had to go.
Yeah. And for our listeners out there, you kind of talked about it earlier of how much you love basketball, how much you love being a player, because although this is an opportunity that's a once in a lifetime opportunity, and you knew that, we told you that, and it was like we had to push you. And it wasn't because you didn't want the opportunity of coaching the NBA. It was because you didn't want to give up being a player. you know, because you love the game that much.
I love playing basketball. I mean, I breathe it, I eat it, I sleep it. When I sit on the toilet, I poop basketball, eat, sleep. That's all it is. And I love competing and bringing out the best in myself. I love battling, and it had nothing to do with the winning. I couldn't tell you where. I know where my MBE is, but every one of those other medals, I couldn't tell you where they are. I got an idea where they at. I know where some. I know some of them is still in the office at the arena. If not all of them. And it was never about that. It was just always about the constant battle. And I love playing. I love being a part of a team. I love working, you know, my tail off. I love figuring out how to win. And, you know, I also knew that as a coach, with me being a player coach, that I had to make lots of sacrifices as a player. I always had to hold back as a player. I always couldn't go out there and play. I always had to turn down shots. I always had to make the extra pass. I always had to be, you know, in the top three in the weight room, in the top three in drills. I always had to be, because at any point in time, everybody was always going to challenge me. Oh, you can do whatever you want because it's your team, because you're the coach of the team. And it became a thing where I always had to sacrifice a lot of my own personal goals for the goal of the team, because I, the coach, was asking Fab, the player, to do this, because if you do that, the team will win. And at the end of the day, Fab, the coach, and Fab, the player, want to win. And there were times where I knew that I had to wait to put myself in. I had to prove myself every time, even when, you know, the biggest stat, everybody can turn around and say, I wasn't this, I wasn't that, I wasn't a point guard, or I was this, or it was ugly. I won. At the end of the day, I won everywhere I've been. I know how to win. And me as a player, I love that. And I love challenging myself. I love figuring out what it takes to do. And, you know, there's things that players should know, you know, how to prepare your body, how to prepare your mind, how to prepare, you know, to help out your teammates, when to, you know, when to do this, when not to do this, when, you know, when to be, you know, when to be a part, when to not be. But when I say not be a part, I'm talking as a player and as a coach, at times of letting things grow, accepting defeat, you know, and breathing it in and inhaling it. And, you know, I just love that. And there was nothing more at peace than that. And I felt, and I kept myself at a point where I'm always 2 weeks away from being in the best shape of my life. And people, and you've been in the weight room with me, you've been on the court with me, and I'm not saying it for justification. It's just that, you know, it's hard for people to understand the things that I was doing, in particular behind the scenes. And, you know, I respect LeBron James to the fullest. The way he's taking care of his body, and the only thing that I'll say about LeBron James, if I had LeBron James, I would play till I'm 60, not 50, because I'm 3 years off of 50. I hate, again, people putting their own limitations on me. The sacrifices and the things out there, because people couldn't understand, well, why would you do it? Because I can. Why would anybody do anything? The reason why people do things is because they can and because they're able to do something. But the reason why people don't do things is because they're unable or they can't do anything. And that's not a negative in the way that I say it. It's just the reality in where I say it. I put everything in a position that's going to help me be successful on the basketball court. And that don't take away from anybody else. You know, I don't have any kids. I decided not to get married. I've decided to have many sacrifices. There's other people. I've made sure that there was nothing that was going to be in my way that was going to take away from me being successful.
as long as I chose to do that. At some point in time, I was going to decide to have a family. And I'll turn around and say, I didn't want to be, you know, and not that it's wrong, not that it's right, but I didn't want to be, you know, a dad and I'm up and down the country and I'm here and, you know, and I'm there and my kid is back in America or my kid is here or that's not something I had wanted to be. You know, and I'm not saying that it's right, wrong, or indifferent. It's just that I had chose a way for myself. I had chose a way that I was going to live my life. And I felt that I was going to give everything to the game and I was going to take everything away from the game. And I wanted long jeopardy. And I wanted long jeopardy because everybody fashioned and when they started playing their game and when they wanted to be the best scorer, they wanted to be the best shooter, they wanted to be the best this, well, I wanted to be the best basketball player. And that meant long jeopardy to me. And long jeopardy, I mean by that, my game was never fashioned off of offense. My game was fashioned off of winning. My game was fashioned off of understanding the game. My game was fashioned off of defense. That never went out of style. You know, and because it never went out of style, you never hear the fact of, oh, he, you hear that I was getting old, but not the fact that I couldn't defend, not the fact that I couldn't rebound, not the fact that I couldn't, you know, and those are the things that matters in championships. When you win championships, it's not about the offense, it's about the defense. I'll give you a prime example of it. Cleveland, they won their first championship. When Cleveland won their first championship, what's the play that won the game for them? Everybody gonna turn around?
LeBron block.
Exactly. Without that block, that it don't happen.
I was giving Drew the answer in chat.
It don't happen. No, any close game, it don't happen without the defense. And my whole thing was, I'm gonna outwork you. There's not gonna be anybody on the court that's gonna outwork me. And if you do outwork me, there's not gonna be anybody on the court that's gonna be smarter than me, that's gonna figure it out. A lot of times I got tagged with, you know, being not sociable or being like that. That was me because I was a player coach. But there's always the game within the game within the game. And I had this thing where I've learned with the BBL that I could tell. It's been many stories, and you know them. I can tell exactly what a player is thinking, exactly what his player is doing, just from how he's walking, just from how he's dribbling the basketball, just from how he's moving. And it was almost the point where I'm studying, like when there was times when I was at games as a basketball player, I'm studying everything. I'm studying how everybody walk into the arena. I'm studying what time they're going to their locker room. I'm studying, you know, who they're talking to, not less than who they're talking to, but who they're talking to. If they're talking to the table because they're worried about their stats, they're talking, you know, to a fan and they worry about, so that way I know when I see that fan or I see that person, I see that table official, I see this, or I see that referee, oh, I see that. I know what's going to happen. I know when we're preparing our practices, when we're about to play, you know, at times we're about to play Cheshire, we don't shoot free throws when we're in Cheshire. So that practice, that whole practice, we're not shooting any free throws. It's just because you see these things over and over again. And then me as a player, I'm preparing for those things. I'm preparing our practices where I'm making our practices harder than the games, because when we get into the games, as a player coach, I'm not trying to coach your game. I want y'all guys to go out there and play. I want to go play. So as a player, for me, there's nothing more special and more sacred than bringing out the best in yourself however you can. And no amount of trophies, no amount of success is ever going to take away from that lust. I cried when Kobe retired. Me and you talked about that. When Kobe retired, I cried. And I cried because, not because he, you know, God bless the dead, obviously, with him passing. But when he retired, I was like, no. Why? Because I can't, that letter, his animation that he got the Oscar, I can't phantom that. I can't phantom when he turned around and said that, you know, his body hurt. He can't do it no more. It's time for him to do something else. I understand that. But for me, I don't want to do anything else. I'm still capable. So just because you have your limitations, I don't have those limitations. I take care of my body. I took care of my body, not as a necessity. I take care of my body because that's my lifestyle. I understand again because that's my lifestyle. And that's what I love to do. It brings me joy. And at every juncture of my life, basketball, my two, my trade has always provided. It has always provided a path for me. It has always provided a way for me. It has always provided everything that I need. And it's such a tool and such a vehicle. And everybody has their basketball. Mine was basketball. Something could be state. It could be a doctor. It could be being a parent. It could be being, you know, a brother, a sister. It could be being a lawyer, physician, whatever. Everybody has their thing that completes them. And basketball completed me. And it didn't complete me so much within the sport of the up and down. It completed me in a way that it helped me to be able to communicate with others. It helped me to bring out the best in others, which bring out the best in myself. And there was this thing where there's this guy, right? And again, I talk in pictures. And when he comes out of his house, and Drew, I've told you this, and he comes out of his house, and when he comes out of his house, there's a fence there. And the fence isn't too high, the fence isn't too low. So when he comes out of his house, he comes out of his house and he jumps over the fence, right? Now there's gonna come a day when he can't jump over that fence. He comes out and he jumps over that fence every single day. And then one day he doesn't jump over the fence. And then another day he don't jump over the fence. Then another day he doesn't jump over the fence. And it comes a point when he can never jump over the fence. My point is, if he comes and he jumps over that fence every day, there's never going to come a day when he can't jump over that fence, as long as he's preparing to jump over that fence. The moment that he stops preparing to jump over the fence will come the day that he can't jump over the fence. And my thing was, everything that I do was preparing to battle and to compete and to be the best and to bring out the best in me. And whatever it took, I was going to do. If I had to scream, I was going to scream. If I had to shout, I was going to shout. If I had to be nice, I was going to be nice. And I was going to apply it to my own personal moral code. And my own personal moral code was I was going to be honest, I was going to be harsh, and I was going to be fair, and I was going to be relentless. And if I, excuse it, and I don't mean to be so dark, if I die doing that and it happened, I'm happy.
Fab, you used the word complete moments ago. And I will say the NBA to me was the complete professional league with how they responded this year to COVID and how they responded to social justice issues, probably in the reverse order, social justice, than COVID. Can you share your thoughts around the NBA's response and maybe the personal impact to you? And just love to hear from you on that topic.
The NBA, with response to social justice and COVID, the NBA is I feel, as a sporting league, is at the forefront of that. And I'm very much happy and proud to be a part of it now. But I also think it's, you know, again, it's basketball that helped transcend a lots of, you know, racial barriers and racial tension, and in particular with Black lives and in particular with racism worldwide, because basketball is just, you know, the racism isn't just in America. Unfortunately, it's all around the world. And I think basketball has helped to break that down and to, you know, address it, you know, and even if you go back as, you know, the NBA, you go back to the ABA, you go back to, you know, the Harlem Globetrotters on traveling and touring the world and that aspect. So the NBA is at the forefront, and there's lots of things that the NBA is doing and probably going to try to do even more. But I think it has to do with, you know, its players and the players that play in the league. And obviously, at the same time, there's still lots of things that they can do in terms of, you know, diversifying the NBA and its structure. But I also feel that that's a replica of what the society is in itself. And what I'm talking about is in high key power positions of power,
you know, and, you know, there's a lot as we talk, as we're doing this and recording now and talking about this now, you know, there's the election that's taking place, and the NBA has helped, along with its players, has helped push forward a time in which is unprecedented and unseen. And with voting, you have more people vote now than ever in the history of voting.
That's amazing, yes.
Yeah. And it's amazing to be a part of that. It's amazing for me to turn around and say it's the first time that I voted myself and felt the need to vote. And it's also a reminder of what our forefathers did to give us the ability to vote that we have not taken advantage of for many years, you know, for what many people have died for and fought for, the right to allow Blacks and minorities to have the opportunity to vote, as well as women having the opportunity to vote. And I think the NBA, as well as the WNBA, is strong advocates and strong voices in creating, you know, awareness and opportunities and starting conversations, that hard conversations, which are needed conversations around the world. And I think and feel that it's important to understand where we are in this day and age, in this time, and things need to get better, will get better, but also will take time. And also, we're not there yet, and we have to continue on from all the forefathers that came before us. And I feel it's never a good thing. And I've known people and I've lost some people that I know through the COVID, with the virus, and, you know, and I never mean it in this way, but I also think the combination of the virus and the untimely death of so many people, in particular, you know, George Floyd, helped this pot just explode with the Black Lives Matter at this point in time, with, you know, the let's call it what it is, a worldwide civil rights movement that has impacted, I think, the NBA and the players, along with within the NBA, is at the forefront of making sure that this opportunity is understood for what we need to do to shape our future, especially the young people. And I think it's huge. We still got a long way to go. And, you know, I don't know the results yet, but when I last looked at the results, it was, you know, it was there. But equally, regardless of what the result shows, you know, it has the turnout of people understanding and educate themselves, and, you know, the history, and, you know, conversations are being had, and people are turning out to vote. People are, you know, are understanding politics better, and they're not turning around and saying that, you know, it's someone else, or it doesn't matter because no one cares. And, you know, and the truth of the matter is, you care, as in I care now, and it's not someone else. And, you know, and we can see that. And as I said before, just the whole thing, and I believe you never want to lose anyone, and I'm sorry for everyone that who has lost someone, but, you know, I think things were meant to happen, and, you know, in this particular way, for everyone to take stock, and then for, you know, the people who aren't, the voices that need to be heard. You know, you have the minority and the Black voice has been heard, but you have to hear the white voice. And, you know, and it's my issue, of the thing that I've always said is, I don't have a problem with, you know, the people or the groups that's the far left. And I actually don't, I'm not saying I don't have a problem. I understand where racism is at, and I understand that there's some people who are going to be knee deep and, you know, going to have their views and, you know, feel that way about other people and other
creeds and other religions and other faiths and other colors, and I get that. And my thing is, I can see them. We can deal with them. My issue is the people that's in the middle that are, well, I don't know, and maybe you need that. No, let's just call it what it is. And it's the people that sit in the middle. I have a saying that I like to use, and I'm not trying to get into the whole religion of thing, and I don't mean to offend anyone, and I apologize if I do, but the saying that I know, and the greatest trick that the devil ever did was make the world believe he doesn't exist. And what I mean by that, and what I take from that in this analogy, is for people to think that racism and people can be that extreme don't exist. Like, people can turn around and say, well, I never thought President Trump could be that way. I never thought that America can do that. I don't believe it. I don't believe that someone can be that cruel. I don't believe, and not necessarily, I don't believe that someone, people can do that. I don't believe that a police officer can kneel on a man's neck for that long. I don't believe that the people can go in and shoot up unarmed women and there'll be no consequences, when our society is raised, or the American society is raised on consequences. And, you know, there are people who are in jail for minor offenses, for jaywalking. And, you know, so it's again, it's the people in the middle that, and I think the NBA is bringing awareness to that. And for me, being able to be in some of those rooms where those conversations are being had, and being able to be a part of some of those actions about, you know, trying to help the younger generation take hold of their future and help reset all the problems and trials and tribulations of our forefathers, of their forefathers, and, you know, in order to get to where we need to do, we have to look at and tell it how it is, the facts of, you know, how we got here. It's not a blame thing. It's just, those are the things that happen. But if we try to, again, say that they don't exist or that they never happened, that's an injustice, and we can't get anywhere. And I think the NBA in particular, and Black Lives Matter, are trying to put those injustices right, try to bring those in. And an injustice is acting as if those things didn't happen, acting as if, you know, those weren't crimes when they were.
Yeah, and major props to the NBA, because I'll take it a step further. What they have done, and you talked about that, they've basically been at the forefront of this, is they've given the confidence to other athletes, someone like myself and other athletes out there, to use our platform and to use our voice. And, you know, with the NBA, it starts at the top, like you talked about, that infrastructure, the leadership, Adam Silver. And Adam Silver has done a great job of allowing those guys to speak out and use their voice, and give them the freedom to not have to be politically correct, which we know in sports a lot of times you have to be to a certain extent, which I talked on an earlier podcast about how, like, for example, we had a guest on here who kind of led the movement in voting for overseas votings. And I told him that I admire him for being like a fourth year player in his career and being so outspoken about it, because we know how, you know, clubs operate and teams. And, you know, when you're early in your career, you got to be careful about what you say and how you move. I just want to give a major shout to the NBA and just piggyback off your back just to say that they've given me the confidence to be able to speak out. But if we wrap this, Fab, we always like to finish the show with talking about, I mean, I know this, but for our listeners, when you're trying to get in that zone, that mood, what's on your playlist, man?
Oh, man. What's on my playlist? You know, it's only one thing on my playlist, and forevermore. Hov.
Artists. Yeah. Well, yeah, I should have asked what artists, because, yeah, it's only going to, if you ever been in a Newcastle Eagle locker room, like, it's always a Jay-Z playlist. And I remember one year I think Fletch might have switched it up or something, and we end up losing at Chester, and you were like, let's get this playlist back to whole.
A question for you.
Yes.
Whatever happened to Virgil?
Virgil is at home in New York, and every time I go back and I see him, I turn around and I say thank you. And we have the silent head shake and nod because he knows and I know.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people that helped me along the way in my journey and got me here indirectly and directly. And I think that's the one thing that a lot of people have to understand. It's not always so much as the direct help. It's the indirect help. Well, not always direct. Not again. I think, you know, when it's, I personally don't like that grind. I mean, I do. I understand the grind.
The journey.
The grind is great and it's hard or whatever. But every time somebody turn around and says the grind, it's hard. They almost say, "Yeah, I'm just grinding," and it's not. That's just a whole negative vibe for me. It's just a whole negative term. I mean, something good comes of it, but you know, I love being in the weight room. I love working hard. I love you. I mean, it becomes a joy. It becomes easy. How can you not like, you know, getting better? Yeah, I'm just grinding. I'm just staying in my lane and, you know, I'm doing this. Nah, I'm being in this lane and I'm doing it and I'm having fun doing it. You know, you have the one thing that I would say, if I can do a little bit better, I would probably, and you know, I did behind the scenes, you know, I never did too much in front because, you know, I don't really like showing anything, you know, publicly and, you know, and sharing in that standpoint. And that's why I'm so happy about your show. Is the fact because you're trying to get the in-depth stuff and, you know, all this stuff and a lot of things I've shared with you before. But it's just, you know, having to get a feel for the real and what's happening and how it happens. And again, what I really like about your show is that, you know, I can tell it and say it and people can, you know, get it and again, enjoy what you do. If I could do it, I would like to, you know, show that there was much more appreciation and I loved every minute of it. May not have showed it, but I loved every minute of it because there's one thing in this world that you cannot ever get back, and it's always moving, and it's more valuable than money. It's more value. It's time. You never get time back. And, you know, is take the opportunity to, you know, invest in your time. Take the opportunity to appreciate your time. Take the opportunity to make the time for the things that you love doing and the people that you love having around you. And that's why I never wanted to give up with the plan. And that's why I was always trying to recreate, you know, those moments, those stories, you know, those championships, those losses, that journey, not the grind, that journey. Because that journey is what's going to make you and appreciate that time, because you're going to be able to tell that story. You're going to be able, you remember that time when, you know, you remember that time when this happened. Oh, you remember that time when you did this. You remember that time, Drew Lasky, when you dunked on that fool. You remember that time when you did this. You remember that time. It's always you remember that time. You don't get that back.
And speaking on time, we here at 21, Yvonne and myself, we really appreciate you taking time out to share your story like never told before. I mean, I know you shared a lot of this stuff privately, but for a lot of people who look up to you, that admire you, that follow you, for them to be able to hear in depth your journey, not your grind, your journey, we are very, very grateful.
Thank you for being here, Fab, and for being a blessing. We appreciate you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate being here. Yeah, and like I said before, I can talk, and no, I really appreciate it, and, you know, it helped me to remember, you know, the times that I had, and, you know, going back and into those emotions and into those places, and having an appreciation for who I am, what I am, and you know, more importantly, all the people who helped me to become the person I am today. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Well, before you go, we're going to pick up the pace a little bit. And Drew, you want to lead us through a game of 21?
Yeah, let's go, man. Before we let you go, we're going to play a little quick game with you where we put you in the hot seat. 21 questions with 21. You ready, man? I know when you get hot, I know when you feel the pressure, the first clue you're going to give us is we're going to see sweat from that forehead, Yvonne. So you look out for that.
Oh, man. I'm sweating now.
First question, Whataburger or In-N-Out?
Neither. I don't eat meat.
Nike or Adidas?
Nike with shoes, Adidas with clothes.
Beer or tequila?
Don't drink alcohol.
Beach or mountains?
Mountain beach.
Tupac or Biggie? You gotta choose one on here.
Biggie.
Jordan or LeBron?
MJ.
Popeyes or Chick-fil-A?
Ooh, back in my chicken eating days, neither one because I'm vegan, but back in my chicken eating days, Popeyes, Louisiana.
Two for Tuesdays. Las Vegas or Miami?
Ooh.
Pick your poison.
Miami at Christmas, Vegas in the summer.
IHOP or Waffle House?
The hop.
East Coast or West Coast?
I can't believe you asked me that question.
You might have got Sadidi on us now, you know what I mean? I know in the NBA y'all spend a lot of time on the West Coast now, you know.
Yeah, we do.
However, and did you just say Sadidi?
wait, just so we clarify. East Coast, all day, every day. Nothing against the West, though. Nothing at all. I love the West, but, you know, I'm from the East. As Biggie said, I'm from the East. I'm from there, so don't go there.
Early bird or night owl?
Both.
Grilled or fried?
Grilled.
Car or truck?
Walk. I'm a walker.
Bluebell or Haagen-Dazs?
Ben and Jerry's, because Ben and Jerry's have a vegan version. It's always Ben and Jerry's.
Coke or Pepsi?
Oh, man. Back in my soda drinking days? Pepsi in my soda drinking days.
Summer or winter?
Summer. Come on, Drew. Come on.
Xbox or PlayStation?
Oh, I don't play video games. I don't have any of them.
Dishes or laundry?
Ooh, laundry.
City or country?
City.
And finally, club or house party?
Oh, wow. Club. You're not messing up my house. You're not messing up my house. That means I have to do dishes and laundry. You ain't messing
facts
up on the club.
Facts. And Fab, you are now off the hot seat. I feel like, Yvonne, we should have tailored this to we need to create a vegan option for this game.
Or we just need to be a bad influence on Fab.
Thanks for playing with us, man. Thank you for your time. We appreciate you, brother.
I appreciate it.
That was great, man.
Appreciate you, Yvonne. That was nice. That was real nice.
Your story is amazing. Please know that you are an amazing storyteller and it's from the heart and you can tell that. And you really need to start reaching back to those who have learning impediments. They need to hear from you.
Yeah, I do and I will for sure.
We're going to hold you to that. Drew's working on his foundation, so you need to be thinking about yours.
Thank you. I will.
Toronto Raptor assistant coach, Fabulous Flournoy.
Thanks to everyone for tuning in. To the athletes, keep being the best that you can be. Run your race with excellence. To the parents of athletes, Let's continue to support our children with patience, grace, and understanding, learning to recognize how to truly become the guides and stewards that we're supposed to be. And we want to hear from you. We want to build a community. Give us your feedback about this episode. And if you have a story you want to share, Drew and I would love to feature you on an upcoming episode of 21.
For more information about services provided by Train Harder 21, visit our website at drewlasker.com and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. It doesn't matter where you are in the world. We provide resources to meet your training needs. Just get in touch with us and subscribe to this podcast series wherever you get your podcasts. Until the next episode of 21, train harder.